and he went to the fire where Juana was squatting, watching the baby's face. The doctor, back in his house, settled into his chair and looked at his watch. His people brought him a little supper of chocolate and sweet cakes and fruit, and he stared at the food discontentedly. In the houses of the neighbors, the subject that would lead all conversations for a long time to come was aired for the first time to see how it would go. The neighbors showed one another with their thumbs how big the pearl was, and they made little caressing gestures to show how lovely it was. From now on, they would watch Kino and Juana very closely to see where the riches turned their heads, as riches turn all people's heads. Everyone knew why the doctor had come. He was not good at dissembling, and he was very well understood. Out in the estuary, a tight, woven school of small fishes glittered and broke water to escape a school of great fishes that drove in to eat them. And in the houses, the people could hear the swish of the small ones and the bouncing splash of the great ones as the slaughter went on. The dampness arose out of the gulf and was deposited on bushes and cacti and on little trees in salty drops. And the night mice crept about on the ground, and the little night hawks hunted them silently. The skinny black puppy with flame spots over his eyes came to Kino's door and looked in. He nearly shook his hindquarters loose when Kino glanced up at him, and he subsided when Kino looked away. The puppy did not enter the house, but he watched with frantic interest while Kino ate his beans from the little pottery dish and wiped it clean with a corn cake and ate the cake and washed the hole down with a drink of pulque. Kino was finished and was rolling a cigarette when Juana spoke sharply. "Kino!" He glanced at her and then got up and went quickly to her, for he saw fright in her eyes. He stood over her, looking down, but the light was very dim. He kicked a pile of twigs into the fire hole to make a blaze, and then he could see the face of Coyotito. The baby's face was flushed, and his throat was working, and a little thick drool of saliva issued from his lips. The spasm of the stomach muscles began, and the baby was very sick. Kino knelt beside his wife. "So the doctor knew," he said. But he said it for himself as well as for his wife, for his mind was hard and suspicious, and he was remembering the white powder. Juana rocked from side to side and moaned out the little song of the family as though it could ward off the danger, and the baby vomited and writhed in her arms. Now uncertainty was in Kino, and the music of evil throbbed in his head and nearly drove out Juana's song. The doctor finished his chocolate and nibbled the little fallen pieces of sweet cake. He brushed his fingers on a napkin, looked at his watch, arose, and took up his little bag. The news of the baby's illness traveled quickly among the brush houses, for sickness is second only to hunger as the enemy of poor people. And some said softly, "Luck, you see, brings bitter friends." And they nodded and got up to go to Kino's house. The neighbors scuttled with covered noses through the dark until they crowded into Kino's house again. They stood and gazed, and they made little comments on the sadness that this should happen at a time of joy, and they said, "All things are in God's hands." The old women squatted down beside Juana to try to give her aid if they could, and comfort if they could not. Then the doctor hurried in, followed by his man. He scattered the old women like chickens. He took the baby and examined it and felt its head. "The poison has worked," he said. "I think I can defeat it. I will try my best." He asked for water, and in the cup of it he put 3 drops of ammonia, and he pried open the baby's mouth and poured it down. The baby spluttered and screeched under the treatment, and Juana watched him with haunted eyes. The doctor spoke a little as he worked. "It is lucky that I know about the poison of the scorpion, otherwise..." And he shrugged to show what could have happened. But Kino was suspicious, and he could not take his eyes from the doctor's open bag and from the bottle of white powder there. Gradually, the spasms subsided, and the baby relaxed under the doctor's hands. And then Coyotito sighed deeply and went to sleep, for he was very tired with vomiting. The doctor put the baby in Juana's arms. "He will get well now," he said. "I have won the fight." And Juana looked at him with adoration. The doctor was closing his bag now. He said, "When do you think you can pay this bill?" He said it even kindly. "When I have sold my pearl, I will pay you," Kino said. "You have a pearl? A good pearl?" the doctor asked with interest. And then the chorus of the neighbors broke in. "He has found the pearl of the world," they cried, and they joined forefinger with thumb to show how great the pearl was. "Kino will be a rich man," they clamored. "It is a pearl such as one has never seen." The doctor looked surprised. "I had not heard of it. Do you keep this pearl in a safe place? Perhaps you would like me to put it in my safe." Kino's eyes were hooded now. His cheeks were drawn taut. "I have it secure," he said. "Tomorrow I will sell it, and then I will pay you." The doctor shrugged, and his wet eyes never left Kino's eyes. He knew the pearl would be buried in the house, and he thought Kino might look toward the place where it was buried. "It would be a shame to have it stolen before you could sell it," the doctor said, and he saw Kino's eyes flick involuntarily to the floor near the sidepost of the brush house. When the doctor had gone and all the neighbors had reluctantly returned to their houses, Kino squatted beside the little glowing coals in the fire hole and listened to the night sound, the soft sweep of the little waves on the shore and the distant barking of dogs, the creeping of the breeze through the brush house roof and the soft speech of his neighbors in their houses in the village. For these people do not sleep soundly all night. They awaken at intervals and talk a little and then go to sleep again. And after a while, Kino got up and went to the door of his house. He smelled the breeze, and he listened for any foreign sound of secrecy or creeping, and his eyes searched the darkness, for the music of evil was sounding in his head, and he was fierce and afraid. After he had probed the night with his senses, he went to the place by the sidepost where the pearl was buried, and he dug it up and brought it to his sleeping mat. And under his sleeping mat he dug another little hole in the dirt floor and buried the pearl and covered it up again. And Juana, sitting by the fire hole, watched him with questioning eyes. And when he had buried his pearl, she asked, "Who do you fear?" Kino searched for a true answer. And at last he said, "Everyone." And he could feel a shell of hardness drawing over him. After a while, they lay down together on the sleeping mat. And Juana did not put the baby in his box tonight, but cradled him in her arms and covered his face with her head shawl. And the last light went out of the embers in the fire hole. But Kino's brain burned, even during his sleep, and he dreamed that Coyotito could read, that one of his own people could tell him the truth of things. And in his dream, Coyotito was reading from a book as large as a house, with letters as big as dogs, and the words galloped and played on the book. And then darkness spread over the page, and with the darkness came the music of evil again, and Kino stirred in his sleep. And when he stirred, Juana's eyes opened in the darkness. And then Kino awakened, with the evil music pulsing in him, and he lay in the darkness with his ears alert. Then, from the corner of the house came a sound so soft that it might have been simply a thought, a little furtive movement, a touch of a foot on earth, the almost inaudible purr of controlled breathing. Kino held his breath to listen, and he knew that whatever dark thing was in his house was holding its breath too to listen. For a time, no sound at all came from the corner of the brush house. Then Kino might have thought he had imagined the sound. But Juana's hand came creeping over to him in warning, and then the sound came again, the whisper of a foot on dry earth and the scratch of fingers in the soil. And now a wild fear surged in Kino's breast, and on the fear came rage, as it always did. Kino's hand crept into his breast where his knife hung on a string, and then he sprang like an angry cat, leaped striking and spitting for the dark thing he knew was in the corner of the house. He felt cloth, struck at it with his knife, and missed, and struck again and felt his knife go through cloth, and then his head crashed with lightning and exploded with pain. There was a soft scurry in the doorway and running steps for a moment, and then silence. Kino could feel warm blood running from his forehead, and he could hear Juana calling to him, "Kino! Kino!" And there was terror in her voice. Then coldness came over him as quickly as the rage had, and he said, "I am all right. The thing has gone." He groped his way back to the sleeping mat. Already Juana was working at the fire. She uncovered an ember from the ashes and shredded little pieces of corn husk over it and blew a little flame into the corn husks so that a tiny light danced through the hut. And then, from a secret place, Juana brought a little piece of consecrated candle and lighted it at the flame and set it upright on a fireplace stone. She worked quickly, crooning as she moved about. She dipped the end of her head shawl in water and swabbed the blood from Kino's bruised forehead. "It is nothing," Kino said. But his eyes and his voice were hard and cold, and a brooding hate was growing in him. Now the tension which had been growing in Juana boiled up to the surface, and her lips were thin. "This thing is evil," she cried harshly. "This pearl is like a sin. It will destroy us." And her voice rose shrilly. "Throw it away, Kino. Let us break it between stones. Let us bury it and forget the place. Let us throw it back into the sea. It has brought evil. Kino, my husband, it will destroy us." And in the firelight, her lips and her eyes were alive with her fear. But Kino's face was set, and his mind and his will were set. "This is our one chance," he said. "Our son must go to school. He must break out of the pot that holds us in." "It will destroy us all," Juana cried. "Even our son." "Hush," said Kino. "Do not speak any more. In the morning we will sell the pearl, and then the evil will be gone, and only the good remain. Now hush, my wife." His dark eyes scowled into the little fire, and for the first time he knew that his knife was still in his hands. And he raised the blade and looked at it, and saw a little line of blood on the steel. For a moment he seemed about to wipe the blade on his trousers, but then he plunged the knife into the earth, and so cleansed it. The distant roosters began to crow, and the air changed, and the dawn was coming. The wind of the morning ruffled the water of the estuary and whispered through the mangroves, and the little waves beat on the rubbly beach with an increased tempo. Kino raised the sleeping mat and dug up his pearl and put it in front of him and stared at it. And the beauty of the pearl, winking and glimmering in the light of the little candle, cozened his brain with its beauty. So lovely it was, so soft. And its own music came from it, its music of promise and delight, its guarantee of the future, of comfort, of security. Its warm lucence promised a poultice against illness and a wall against insult. It closed a door on hunger. And as he stared at it, Kino's eyes softened and his face relaxed. He could see the little image of the consecrated candle reflected in the soft surface of the pearl. And he heard again in his ears the lovely music of the undersea, the tone of the diffused green light of the sea bottom. Juana, glancing secretly at him, saw him smile. And because they were in some way one thing and one purpose, she smiled with him. And they began this day with hope. 4. It is wonderful the way a little town keeps track of itself and of all its units. If every single man and woman, child and baby, acts and conducts itself in a known pattern, and breaks no walls and differs with no one, and experiments in no way, and is not sick and does not endanger the ease and peace of mind or steady, unbroken flow of the town, then that unit can disappear and never be heard of. But let one man step out of the regular thought or the known and trusted pattern, and the nerves of the townspeople ring with nervousness, and communication travels over the nerve lines of the town. Then every unit communicates to the whole. Thus, in La Paz, it was known in the early morning through the whole town that Kino was going to sell his pearl that day. It was known among the neighbors in the brush huts, among the pearl fishermen. It was known among the Chinese grocery store owners. It was known in the church, for the altar boys whispered about it. Word of it crept in among the nuns. The beggars in front of the church spoke of it, for they would be there to take the tithe of the first fruits of the luck. The little boys knew about it with excitement, but most of all the pearl buyers knew about it. And when the day had come, in the offices of the pearl buyers, each man sat alone with his little black velvet tray, and each man rolled the pearls about with his fingertips and considered his part in the picture. It was supposed that the pearl buyers were individuals acting alone, bidding against one another for the pearls the fishermen brought in. And once it had been so. But this was a wasteful method, for often in the excitement of bidding for a fine pearl, too great a price had been paid to the fishermen. This was extravagant and not to be countenanced. Now there was only one pearl buyer with many hands, and the men who sat in their offices and waited for Kino knew what price they would offer, how high they would bid, and what method each one would use. And although these men would not profit beyond their salaries, there was excitement among the pearl buyers, for there was excitement in the hunt. And if it be a man's function to break down a price, then he must take joy and satisfaction in breaking it as far down as possible. For every man in the world functions to the best of his ability, and no one does less than his best, no matter what he may think about it. Quite apart from any reward they might get, from any word of praise, from any promotion, a pearl buyer was a pearl buyer, and the best and happiest pearl buyer was he who bought for the lowest prices. The sun was hot yellow that morning, and it drew the moisture from the estuary and from the gulf, and hung it in shimmering scarves in the air, so that the air vibrated and vision was insubstantial. A vision hung in the air to the north of the city, the vision of a mountain that was over 200 miles away, and the high slopes of this mountain were swaddled with pines, and a great stone peak arose above the timberline. And the morning of this day, the canoes lay lined up on the beach. The fishermen did not go out to dive for pearls, for there would be too much happening, too many things to see when Kino went to sell the great pearl. In the brush houses by the shore, Kino's neighbors sat long over their breakfast, and they spoke of what they would do if they had found the pearl. And one man said that he would give it as a present to the Holy Father in Rome. Another said that he would buy masses for the souls of his family for 1,000 years. Another thought he might take the money and distribute it among the poor of La Paz. And a fourth thought of all the good things one could do with the money from the pearl, of all the charities, benefits, of all the rescues one could perform if one had money. All of the neighbors hoped that sudden wealth would not turn Kino's head, would not make a rich man of him, would not graft onto him the evil limbs of greed and hatred and coldness. For Kino was a well-liked man. It would be a shame if the pearl destroyed him. That good wife, Juana, they said, and the beautiful baby, Coyotito, and the others to come. What a pity it would be if the pearl should destroy them all. For Kino and Juana, this was the morning of mornings of their lives, comparable only to the day when the baby had been born. This was to be the day from which all other days would take their arrangement. Thus, they would say, it was 2 years before we sold the pearl, or it was 6 weeks after we sold the pearl. Juana, considering the matter, threw caution to the winds, and she dressed Coyotito in the clothes she had prepared for his baptism, when there would be money for his baptism. And Juana combed and braided her hair, and tied the ends with two little bows of red ribbon, and she put on her marriage skirt and waist. The sun was quarter high when they were ready. Kino's ragged white clothes were clean, at least, and this was the last day of his raggedness. For tomorrow, or even this afternoon, he would have new clothes. The neighbors, watching Kino's door through the crevices in their brush houses, were dressed and ready, too. There was no self-consciousness about their joining Kino and Juana to go pearl selling. It was expected. It was an historic moment. They would be crazy if they didn't go. It would be almost a sign of unfriendship. Juana put on her head shawl carefully, and she draped one long end under her right elbow and gathered it with her right hand, so that a hammock hung under her arm. And in this little hammock she placed Coyotito, propped up against the head shawl so that he could see everything and perhaps remember. Kino put on his large straw hat and felt it with his hand to see that it was properly placed, not on the back or side of his head like a rash, unmarried, irresponsible man, and not flat as an elder would wear it, but tilted a little forward to show aggressiveness and seriousness and vigor. There is a great deal to be seen in the tilt of a hat on a man. Kino slipped his feet into his sandals and pulled the thongs up over his heels. The great pearl was wrapped in an old soft piece of deerskin and placed in a little leather bag, and the leather bag was in a pocket in Kino's shirt. He folded his blanket carefully and draped it in a narrow strip over his left shoulder, and now they were ready. Kino stepped with dignity out of the house, and Juana followed him carrying Coyotito. And as they marched up the freshet-washed alley toward the town, the neighbors joined them. The houses belched people, the doorways spewed out children. But because of the seriousness of the occasion, only one man walked with Kino, and that was his brother, Juan Tomas. Juan Tomas cautioned his brother. "You must be careful to see they do not cheat you," he said. And, "Very careful," Kino agreed. "We do not know what prices are paid in other places," said Juan Tomas. "How can we know what is a fair price if we do not know what the pearl buyer gets for the pearl in another place?" "That is true," said Kino. "But how can we know? We are here, we are not there." As they walked up toward the city, the crowd grew behind them, and Juan Tomas, in pure nervousness, went on speaking. "Before you were born, Kino," he said, "the old ones thought of a way to get more money for their pearls. They thought it would be better if they had an agent who took all the pearls to the capital and sold them there and kept only his share of the profit." Kino nodded his head. "I know," he said. "It was a good thought." "And so they got such a man," said Juan Tomas, "and they pooled their pearls, and they started him off, and he was never heard of again, and the pearls were lost. Then they got another man, and they started him off, and he was never heard of again. And so they gave the whole thing up, and went back to the old way." "I know," said Kino. "I have heard our father tell of it. It was a good idea, but it was against religion, and the father made that very clear. The loss of the pearl was a punishment, visited on those who tried to leave their station. And the father made it clear that each man and woman is like a soldier sent by God to guard some part of the castle of the universe. And some are in the ramparts, and some far deep in the darkness of the walls, but each one must remain faithful to his post and must not go running about, else the castle is in danger from the assaults of hell." "I have heard him make that sermon," said Juan Tomas. "He makes it every year." The brothers, as they walked along, squinted their eyes a little, as they and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers had done for 400 years, since first the strangers came with argument and authority and gunpowder to back up both. And in the 400 years, Kino's people had learned only one defense. A slight slitting of the eyes and a slight tightening of the lips, and a retirement. Nothing could break down this wall, and they could remain whole within the wall. The gathering procession was solemn, for they sensed the importance of this day. And any children who showed a tendency to scuffle, to scream, to cry out, to steal hats and rumple hair, were hissed to silence by their elders. So important was this day that an old man came to see riding on the stalwart shoulders of his nephew. The procession left the brush huts and entered the stone and plaster city, where the streets were a little wider and there were narrow pavements beside the buildings. And, as before, the beggars joined them as they passed the church. The grocers looked out at them as they went by. The little saloons lost their customers, and the owners closed up shop and went along. And the sun beat down on the streets of the city, and even tiny stones threw shadows on the ground. The news of the approach of the procession ran ahead of it, and in their little dark offices the pearl buyers stiffened and grew alert. They got out papers so they could be at work when Kino appeared, and they put their pearls in the desks, for it is not good to let an inferior pearl be seen beside a beauty. And word of the loveliness of Kino's pearl had come to them. The pearl buyer's offices were clustered together in one narrow street, and they were barred at the windows, and wooden slats cut out the light, so that only a soft gloom entered the offices. A stout, slow man sat in an office waiting. His face was fatherly and benign, and his eyes twinkled with friendship. He was a caller of good mornings, a ceremonious shaker of hands, a jolly man who knew all jokes, and yet who hovered close to sadness. For in the midst of a laugh he could remember the death of your aunt, and his eyes could become wet with sorrow for your loss. This morning he had placed a flower in a vase on his desk, a single scarlet hibiscus, and the vase sat beside the black velvet-lined pearl tray in front of him. He was shaved close to the blue roots of his beard, and his hands were clean and his nails polished. His door stood open to the morning, and he hummed under his breath while his right hand practiced legerdemain. He rolled a coin back and forth over his knuckles and made it appear and disappear, made it spin and sparkle. The coin winked into sight and as quickly slipped out of sight, and the man did not even watch his own performance. The fingers did it all mechanically, precisely, while the man hummed to himself and peered out the door. Then he heard the tramp of feet of the approaching crowd, and the fingers of his right hand worked faster and faster until, as the figure of Kino filled the doorway, the coin flashed and disappeared. "Good morning, my friend," the stout man said. "What can I do for you?" Kino stared into the dimness of the little office, for his eyes were squeezed from the outside glare. But the buyer's eyes had become as steady and cruel and unwinking as a hawk's eyes, while the rest of his face smiled in greeting. And secretly behind his desk, his right hand practiced with the coin. "I have a pearl," said Kino. And Juan Tomas stood beside him and snorted a little at the understatement. The neighbors peered around the doorway, and a line of little boys clambered on the window bars and looked through. Several little boys, on their hands and knees, watched the scene around Kino's legs. "You have a pearl," the dealer said. "Sometimes a man brings in a dozen. Well, let us see your pearl. We will value it and give you the best price." And his fingers worked furiously with the coin. Now Kino instinctively knew his own dramatic effects. Slowly he brought out the leather bag, slowly took from it the soft and dirty piece of deerskin, and then he let the great pearl roll into the black velvet tray, and instantly his eyes went to the buyer's face. But there was no sign, no movement. The face did not change, but the secret hand behind the desk missed in its precision. The coin stumbled over a knuckle and slipped silently into the dealer's lap. And the fingers behind the desk curled into a fist. When the right hand came out of hiding, the forefinger touched the great pearl, rolled it on the black velvet. Thumb and forefinger picked it up and brought it near to the dealer's eyes and twirled it in the air. Kino held his breath, and the neighbors held their breath, and the whispering went back through the crowd. He is inspecting it. No price has been mentioned yet. They have not come to a price. Now the dealer's hand had become a personality. The hand tossed the great pearl back in the tray. The forefinger poked and insulted it, and on the dealer's face there came a sad and contemptuous smile. "I am sorry, my friend," he said, and his shoulders rose a little to indicate that the misfortune was no fault of his. "It is a pearl of great value," Kino said. The dealer's finger spurned the pearl so that it bounced and rebounded softly from the side of the velvet tray. "You have heard of fool's gold," the dealer said. "This pearl is like fool's gold. It is too large. Who would buy it? There is no market for such things. It is a curiosity only. I am sorry. You thought it was a thing of value, and it is only a curiosity." Now Kino's face was perplexed and worried. "It is the pearl of the world," he cried. "No one has ever seen such a pearl."
"On the contrary," said the dealer, "it is large and clumsy. As a curiosity, it has interest. Some museum might perhaps take it to a place in a collection of seashells. I can give you, say, 1,000 pesos.
Kino's face grew dark and dangerous. "It is worth 50,000, he said. "You know it. You want to cheat me." And the dealer heard a little grumble go through the crowd as they heard his price, and the dealer felt a little tremor of fear.
"Do not blame me," he said quickly. "I am only an appraiser. Ask the others. Go to their offices and show your pearl, or better, let them come here so that you can see there is no collusion. Boy," he called. And when his servant looked through the rear door, "Boy, go to such a one and such another one and such a third one. Ask them to step in here and do not tell them why. Just say that I will be pleased to see them."
And his right hand went behind the desk and pulled another coin from his pocket, and the coin rolled back and forth over the knuckles. Kino's neighbors whispered together. They had been afraid of something like this. The pearl was large, but it had a strange color. They'd been suspicious of it from the first. And after all, 1,000 pesos was not to be thrown away. It was comparative wealth to a man who was not wealthy. And suppose Kino took 1,000 pesos. Only yesterday he had nothing. But Kino had grown tight and hard. He felt the creeping of fate, the circling of wolves, the hover of vultures. He felt the evil coagulating about him, and he was helpless to protect himself. He heard in his ears the evil music. And on the black velvet the great pearl glistened, so that the dealer could not keep his eyes from it. The crowd in the doorway wavered and broke and let the 3 pearl dealers through. The crowd was silent now, fearing to miss a word, to fail to see a gesture or an expression. Kino was silent and watchful. He felt a little tugging at his back, and he turned and looked in Juana's eyes. And when he looked away, he had renewed strength. The dealers did not glance at one another nor at the pearl. The man behind the desk said, "I have put a value on this pearl. The owner here does not think it fair. I will ask you to examine this thing and make an offer. Notice," he said to Kino, "I have not mentioned what I have offered." The first dealer, dry and stringy, seemed now to see the pearl for the first time. He took it up, rolled it quickly between thumb and forefinger, and then cast it contemptuously back into the tray. "Do not include me in the discussion," he said dryly. "I will make no offer at all. I do not want it. This is not a pearl. It is a monstrosity." His thin lips curled. Now the second dealer, a little man with a shy, soft voice, took up the pearl, and he examined it carefully. He took a glass from his pocket and inspected it under magnification. Then he laughed softly. "Better pearls are made of paste," he said. "I know these things. This is soft and chalky. It will lose its color and die in a few months. Look." He offered the glass to Kino, showed him how to use it, And Kino, who had never seen a pearl surface magnified, was shocked at the strange-looking surface. The third dealer took the pearl from Kino's hands.
"One of my clients likes such things," he said. "I will offer 500 pesos, and perhaps I can sell it to my client for 600.
Kino reached quickly and snatched the pearl from his hand. He wrapped it in the deerskin and thrust it inside his shirt. The man behind the desk said,
"I'm a fool, I know, but my first offer stands. I still offer 1,000.
"What are you doing?" he asked, as Kino thrust the pearl out of sight.
"I am cheated!" Kino cried fiercely. "My pearl is not for sale here. I will go, perhaps even to the capital."
Now the dealers glanced quickly at one another. They knew they had played too hard. They knew they would be disciplined for their failure, and the man at the desk said quickly,
"I might go to 1,500.
But Kino was pushing his way through the crowd. The hum of talk came to him dimly. His rage blood pounded in his ears, and he burst through and strode away. Juana followed, trotting after him. When the evening came, the neighbors in the brush houses sat eating their corn cakes and beans, and they discussed the great theme of the morning. They did not know. It seemed a fine pearl to them, but they had never seen such a pearl before, and surely the dealers knew more about the value of pearls than they. "And mark this," they said. Those dealers did not discuss these things. Each of the three knew the pearl was valueless. But suppose they had arranged it before?
"If that is so, then all of us have been cheated all of our lives."
"Perhaps," some argued, "perhaps it would have been better if Kino took the 1,500 pesos. That is a great deal of money, more than he has ever seen. Maybe Kino is being a pig-headed fool. Suppose he should really go to the capital and find no buyer for his pearl. He would never live that down." "And now," said other fearful ones, "now that he had defied them, those buyers will not want to deal with him at all. Maybe Kino has cut off his own head and destroyed himself." And others said, "Kino is a brave man, and a fierce man. He is right. From his courage we may all profit." These were proud of Kino. In his house, Kino squatted on his sleeping mat, brooding. He had buried his pearl under a stone of the fire hole in his house, and he stared at the woven tules of his sleeping mat until the cross design danced in his head. He had lost one world and had not gained another. And Kino was afraid. Never in his life had he been far from home. He was afraid of strangers and of strange places. He was terrified of that monster of strangeness they called the capital. It lay over the water and through the mountains, over 1,000 miles, and every strange, terrible mile was frightening. But Kino had lost his old world, and he must clamber on to a new one. For his dream of the future was real and never to be destroyed. And he had said, "I will go," and that made a real thing, too. To determine to go and to say it was to be halfway there. Juana watched him while he buried his pearl, and she watched him while she cleaned Coyotito and nursed him, and Juana made the corn cakes for supper. Juan Tomas came in and squatted down beside Kino and remained silent for a long time, until at last Kino demanded, "What else could I do? They are cheats." Juan Tomas nodded gravely. He was the elder, and Kino looked to him for wisdom. "It is hard to know," he said. "We do know that we are cheated from birth to the overcharge in our coffins. But we survive. You have defied not the pearl buyers, but the whole structure, the whole way of life. And I am afraid for you."
"What have I to fear but starvation?" Kino asked.
But Juan Tomas shook his head slowly. "That we must all fear. But suppose you are correct. Suppose your pearl is of great value. Do you think then the game is over?"
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know," said Juan Tomas, "but I am afraid for you. It is new ground you are walking on. You do not know the way."
"I will go. I will go soon," said Kino.
"Yes," Juan Tomas agreed. That you must do. But I wonder if you will find it any different in the capital. Here you have friends, and me, your brother. There you will have no one.
What can I do? Kino cried. Some deep outrage is here. My son must have a chance. That is what they are striking at. My friends will protect me.
Only so long as they are not in danger or discomfort from it, said Juan Tomas. He arose, saying, Go with God. And Kino said, Go with God, and did not even look up, for the words had a strange chill in them. Long after Juan Tomas had gone, Kino sat brooding on his sleeping mat. A lethargy had settled on him, and a little gray hopelessness. Every road seemed blocked against him. In his head he heard only the dark music of the enemy. His senses were burningly alive, but his mind went back to the deep participation with all things, the gift he had from his people. He heard every little sound of the gathering night, the sleepy complaint of settling birds, the love agony of cats, the strike and withdrawal of little waves on the beach, and the simple hiss of distance. And he could smell the sharp odor of exposed kelp from the receding tide. The little flare of the twig fire made the design on his sleeping mat jump before his entranced eyes. Juana watched him with worry, but she knew him, and she knew she could help him best by being silent and by being near. And as though she too could hear the song of evil, she fought it, singing softly the melody of the family, of the safety and warmth and wholeness of the family. She held Coyotito in her arms and sang the song to him to keep the evil out, and her voice was brave against the threat of the dark music. Kino did not move nor ask for his supper. She knew he would ask when he wanted it. His eyes were entranced, and he could sense the wary, watchful evil outside the brush house. He could feel the dark, creeping things waiting for him to go out into the night. It was shadowy and dreadful, and yet it called to him and threatened him and challenged him. His right hand went into his shirt and felt his knife. His eyes were wide. He stood up and walked to the doorway. Juana willed to stop him. She raised her hand to stop him, and her mouth opened with terror. For a long moment, Kino looked out into the darkness, and then he stepped outside. Juana heard the little rush, the grunting struggle, the blow. She froze with terror for a moment, and then her lips drew back from her teeth like a cat's lips. She set Coyotito down on the ground. She seized a stone from the fireplace and rushed outside. But it was over by then. Kino lay on the ground, struggling to rise, and there was no one near him. Only the shadows and the strike and rush of waves and the hiss of distance. But the evil was all about, hidden behind the brush fence, crouched beside the house in the shadow, hovering in the air. Juana dropped her stone and she put her arms around Kino and helped him to his feet and supported him into the house. Blood oozed down from his scalp, and there was a long, deep cut in his cheek from ear to chin, a deep, bleeding slash. And Kino was only half conscious. He shook his head from side to side. His shirt was torn open and his clothes half pulled off. Juana sat him down on his sleeping mat, and she wiped the thickening blood from his face with her skirt. She brought him pulque to drink in a little pitcher, and still he shook his head to clear out the darkness.
Who?
Juana asked.
I don't know, Kino said. I didn't see.
Now Juana brought her clay pot of water, and she washed the cut on his face while he stared dazed ahead of him.
Kino, my husband, she cried,
and his eyes stared past her.
Kino, can you hear me?
I hear you, he said dully.
Kino, this pearl is evil. Let us destroy it before it destroys us. Let us crush it between two stones. Let us throw it back in the sea where it belongs. Kino, it is evil. It is evil.
And as she spoke, the light came back in Kino's eyes, so that they glowed fiercely, and his muscles hardened, and his will hardened. No,
he said. I will fight this thing. I will win over it. We will have our chance. His fist pounded the sleeping mat. No one shall take our good fortune from us, he said. His eyes softened then, and he raised a gentle hand to Juana's shoulder. Believe me, he said, I am a man. And his face grew crafty. In the morning we will take our canoe, and we will go over the sea and over the mountains to the capital, you and I. We will not be cheated. I am a man. Kino, she said huskily, I am afraid. A man can be killed. Let us throw the pearl back into the sea. Hush, he said fiercely. I am a man. Hush! And she was silent, for his voice was command. Let us sleep a little, he said. In the first light we will start. You are not afraid to go with me?
No, my husband.
His eyes were soft and warm on her then. His hand touched her cheek. Let us sleep a little, he said.
This ends Disc 2. The Pearl, Disc 3.
5. The late moon arose before the first rooster crowed. Kino opened his eyes in the darkness, for he sensed movement near him, but he did not move. Only his eyes searched the darkness, and in the pale light of the moon that crept through the holes in the brush house, Kino saw Juana arise silently from beside him. He saw her move toward the fireplace. So carefully did she work that he heard only the lightest sound when she moved the fireplace stone. And then, like a shadow, she glided toward the door. She paused for a moment beside the hanging box where Coyotito lay, then for a second she was black in the doorway, and then she was gone. And rage surged in Kino. He rolled up to his feet and followed her, as silently as she had gone, and he could hear her quick footsteps going toward the shore. Quietly he tracked her, and his brain was red with anger. She burst clear out of the brush line and stumbled over the little boulders toward the water, and then she heard him coming, and she broke into a run. Her arm was up to throw when he leaped at her and caught her arm and wrenched the pearl from her. He struck her in the face with his clenched fist, and she fell among the boulders, and he kicked her in the side. In the pale light he could see the little waves break over her, and her skirt floated about and clung to her legs as the water receded. Kino looked down at her, and his teeth were bared. He hissed at her like a snake, and Juana stared at him with wide, unfrightened eyes, like a sheep before the butcher. She knew there was murder in him, and it was all right. She had accepted it, and she would not resist or even protest. And then the rage left him, and a sick disgust took its place. He turned away from her and walked up the beach and through the brush line. His senses were dulled by his emotion. He heard the rush, got his knife out, and lunged at one dark figure and felt his knife go home. And then he was swept to his knees and swept again to the ground. Greedy fingers went through his clothes, frantic figures searched him, and the pearl, knocked from his hand, lay winking behind a little stone in the pathway. It glinted in the soft moonlight. Juana dragged herself up from the rocks on the edge of the water. Her face was a dull pain, and her side ached. She steadied herself on her knees for a while, and her wet skirt clung to her. There was no anger in her for Kino. He had said, I am a man, and that meant certain things to Juana. It meant that he was half insane and half God. It meant that Kino would drive his strength against a mountain and plunge his strength against the sea. Juana, in her woman's soul, knew that the mountain would stand while the man broke himself, that the sea would surge while the man drowned in it. And yet it was this thing that made him a man, half insane and half God, and Juana had need of a man. She could not live without a man. Although she might be puzzled by these differences between man and woman, she knew them and accepted them and needed them. Of course she would follow him. There was no question of that.
Sometimes the quality of woman, the reason, the caution, the sense of preservation could cut through Kino's madness and save them all. She climbed painfully to her feet, and she dipped her cupped palms in the little waves and washed her bruised face with the stinging salt water, and then she went creeping up the beach after Kino. A flight of herring clouds had moved over the sky from the south. The pale moon dipped in and out of the strands of clouds so that Juana walked in darkness for a moment and in light the next. Her back was bent with pain and her head was low. She went through the line of brush when the moon was covered, and when it looked through, she saw the glimmer of the great pearl in the path behind the rock. She sank to her knees and picked it up, and the moon went into the darkness of the clouds again. Juana remained on her knees while she considered whether to go back to the sea and finish her job, and as she considered, the light came again, and she saw two dark figures lying in the path ahead of her. She leaped forward and saw that one was Kino and the other a stranger, with dark, shiny fluid leaking from his throat. Kino moved sluggishly, arms and legs stirred like those of a crushed bug, and a thick muttering came from his mouth. Now, in an instant, Juana knew that the old life was gone forever. A dead man in the path and Kino's knife, dark-bladed beside him, convinced her. All of the time, Juana had been trying to rescue something of the old peace, of the time before the pearl. But now it was gone, and there was no retrieving it. And knowing this, she abandoned the past instantly. There was nothing to do but to save themselves. Her pain was gone now, her slowness. Quickly she dragged the dead man from the pathway into the shelter of the brush. She went to Kino and sponged his face with her wet skirt. His senses were coming back, and he moaned. "They have taken the pearl. I have lost it. Now it is over," he said. "The pearl is gone." Juana quieted him as she would quiet a sick child. "Hush," she said. "Here is your pearl. I found it in the path. Can you hear me now? Here is your pearl. Can you understand? You have killed a man. We must go away. They will come for us. Can you understand? We must be gone before the daylight comes." "I was attacked," Kino said uneasily. "I struck to save my life." "Do you remember yesterday?" Juana asked. "Do you think that will matter? Do you remember the men of the city? Do you think your explanation will help?" Kino drew a great breath and fought off his weakness. "No," he said. "You are right." And his will hardened, and he was a man again. "Go to our house and bring Coyotito," he said, "and bring all the corn we have. I will drag the canoe into the water, and we will go." He took his knife and left her. He stumbled toward the beach, and he came to his canoe. And when the light broke through again, he saw that a great hole had been knocked in the bottom. And a searing rage came to him and gave him strength. Now the darkness was closing in on his family. Now the evil music filled the night, hung over the mangroves, skirled in the wave beat. The canoe of his grandfather plastered over and over, and a splintered hole broken in it. This was an evil beyond thinking. The killing of a man was not so evil as the killing of a boat, for a boat does not have sons, and a boat cannot protect itself, and a wounded boat does not heal. There was sorrow in Kino's rage, but this last thing had tightened him beyond breaking. He was an animal now, for hiding, for attacking, and he lived only to preserve himself and his family. He was not conscious of the pain in his head. He leaped up the beach, through the brush line, toward his brush house, and it did not occur to him to take one of the canoes of his neighbors. Never once did the thought enter his head, any more than he could have conceived breaking a boat. The roosters were crowing, and the dawn was not far off. Smoke of the first fires seeped out through the walls of the brush houses, and the first smell of cooking corn cakes was in the air. Already the dawn birds were scampering in the bushes. The weak moon was losing its light, and the clouds thickened and curdled to the southward. The wind blew freshly into the estuary, a nervous, restless wind with the smell of storm on its breath, and there was change and uneasiness in the air. Kino, hurrying toward his house, felt a surge of exhilaration. Now he was not confused, for there was only one thing to do, and Kino's hand went first to the great pearl in his shirt and then to his knife hanging under his shirt. He saw a little glow ahead of him, and then, without interval, a tall flame leaped up in the dark with a crackling roar, and a tall edifice of fire lighted the pathway. Kino broke into a run. It was his brush house, he knew, and he knew that these houses could burn down in a very few moments, and as he ran, a scuttling figure ran toward him, Juana, with Coyotito in her arms, and Kino's shoulder blanket clutched in her hand. The baby moaned with fright, and Juana's eyes were wide and terrified. Kino could see the house was gone, and he did not question Juana. He knew, but she said, "It was torn up, and the floor dug. Even the baby's box turned out, and as I looked, they put the fire to the outside." The fierce light of the burning house lighted Kino's face strongly. "Who?" he demanded.
"I don't know," she said. "The Dark Ones."
The neighbors were tumbling from their houses now, and they watched the falling sparks and stamped them out to save their own houses. Suddenly Kino was afraid. The light made him afraid. He remembered the man lying dead in the brush beside the path, and he took Juana by the arm and drew her into the shadow of a house away from the light, for light was danger to him. For a moment he considered, and then he worked among the shadows until he came to the house of Juan Tomas, his brother, and he slipped into the doorway and drew Juana after him. Outside he could hear the squeal of children and the shouts of the neighbors, for his friends thought he might be inside the burning house. The house of Juan Tomas was almost exactly like Kino's house. Nearly all the brush houses were alike, and all leaked light and air, so that Juana and Kino, sitting in the corner of the brother's house, could see the leaping flames through the wall. They saw the flames, tall and furious, they saw the roof fall, and watched the fire die down as quickly as a twig fire dies. They heard the cries of warning of their friends, and the shrill, keening cry of Apollonia, wife of Juan Tomas. She, being the nearest woman relative, raised a formal lament for the dead of the family. Apollonia realized that she was wearing her second best head shawl, and she rushed to her house to get her fine new one. As she rummaged in a box by the wall, Kino's voice said quietly, "Apollonia, do not cry out. We are not hurt."
"How do you come here?" she demanded.
"Do not question," he said. "Go now to Juan Tomas and bring him here and tell no one else. This is important to us, Apollonia." She paused, her hands helpless in front of her, and then,
"Yes, my brother-in-law," she said.
In a few moments, Juan Tomas came back with her. He lighted a candle and came to them where they crouched in a corner, and he said, "Apollonia, see to the door, and do not let anyone enter." He was older, Juan Tomas, and he assumed the authority. "Now, my brother," he said. "I was attacked in the dark," said Kino, "and in the fight I have killed a man." "Who?" asked Juan Tomas quickly. "I do not know. It is all darkness, and shape of darkness."
"It is the pearl," said Juan Tomas. "There is a devil in this pearl. You should have sold it and passed on the devil. Perhaps you can still sell it and buy peace for yourself."
And Kino said,
"Oh, my brother, an insult has been put on me that is deeper than my life. For on the beach my canoe is broken, my house is burned, and in the brush a dead man lies. Every escape is cut off. You must hide us, my brother."
And Kino, looking closely, saw deep worry come into his brother's eyes, and he forestalled him in a possible refusal.
"Not for long," he said quickly. "Only until a day has passed and the new night has come. Then we will go."
"I will hide you," said Juan Tomas.
"I do not want to bring danger to you," Kino said. "I know I am like a leprosy. I will go tonight, and then you will be safe."
"I will protect you," said Juan Tomas.
And he called, "Apollonia, close up the door. Do not even whisper that Kino is here." They sat silently all day in the darkness of the house, and they could hear the neighbors speaking of them. Through the walls of the house, they could watch their neighbors raking through the ashes to find the bones. Crouching in the house of Juan Tomas, they heard the shock go into their neighbors' minds at the news of the broken boat. Juan Tomas went out among the neighbors to divert their suspicions, and he gave them theories and ideas of what had happened to Kino and to Juana and to the baby. To